You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hey folks, before we begin, I want to tell you about a fantastic cause. The Comedy Store just did a live broadcast featuring many of your favorite comedians that raised over $100,000 for the Comedy Store Family Fund, benefiting its employees and comedians who are all out of work right now. And God knows we need a laugh more than ever right now. So you can still watch the show on demand through the Comedy Store channel on Roku. And the benefit show will also be out as three comedy specials on Apple TV and Xbox beginning Monday, April 27th. The spectacular lineup includes Whitney Cummings, Chris D'Elia, Bobby Lee, Andrew Santino and Tim Dillon, Joey Diaz, Tom Segura, Burt Kreischer and Theo Vaughn, Neil Brennan, Bill Burr, Donnell Rawlings, and special guest Dave Chappelle. And while you're having some laughs, donate by texting TCS Family to 41444. Because comedians are struggling right now, just like everyone else. They can't get out to clubs and perform in front of a live audience, and they've got to make a living and support their families, too. Again, check out the Comedy Store benefit on demand through the Comedy Store channel on Roku or on Apple TV and Xbox starting today. And text TCS Family to 41444 to donate. Again, that's TCS Family to 41444. Thanks, guys, and now on with the show. Charismatic and complex, Sergio Vieira de Mello spent the majority of his storied career as a top UN diplomat, working in the world's most unstable regions, deftly navigating deals with presidents, revolutionaries, and war criminals for the sake of protecting the lives of ordinary people. But just as he readied himself for a simpler life with the woman he loved, Sergio took one last assignment in Baghdad, newly plunged into chaos following the U.S. invasion. The assignment was meant to be brief until a bomb blast caused the walls of the U.N. headquarters to come literally crashing down upon him. Now, this tragic true story has inspired a new Netflix film called Sergio, starring Brazilian actor Wagner Moura as the late diplomat. And today, Wagner joins me on the podcast to discuss how his first career as a journalist informs his acting today, what it was like playing ruthless drug lord Pablo Escobar on Netflix Narcos, and how he gained and then lost all that weight for the role. He talks about his long-held fascination with Brazilian-born human rights advocate Sergio de Mello, and how he hopes that this film will have a positive impact on how Latin Americans are portrayed in Hollywood. He also says that working with famed war correspondent turned director Greg Barker added extra authenticity to Sergio. He reveals that they even used real-life refugees as extras on the film, and he theorizes that Iraq might have turned out very differently if Sergio de Mello had lived to complete his mission. Plus, what political leaders who are dealing with the coronavirus could learn from this revered diplomat and humanitarian. Coming up with Wagner Moura in just a moment. Brazilian stage, film, and television actor Wagner Moura is widely considered one of South America's most popular talents. U.S. audiences know him as the notorious Pablo Escobar in Netflix's critically acclaimed series Narcos, which garnered both the show and Moura Golden Globe nominations. Now he stars as the real-life UN diplomat Sergio Vieira de Mello in the movie Sergio, also now out on Netflix. Wagner Moura, welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, Wagner, you star as a real-life diplomat in some of the most war-torn regions of the world in Sergio, and I was interested to read that I guess you originally started out as a journalist before you got into acting. Did your experience as a news reporter come in handy for this role?
Yes, I was acting. I was acting since I was 15, but when I got to the moment where I should decide what to do in terms of academics, I always liked journalism, and I liked to write, and so I decided to do journalism. But it was a good experience for me. I've worked in a newspaper for a while, but I think the fact that I graduated in journalism, my interest in what was going on around the world the news and the made me choose the kind of things that I choose when I decide what I want to do as an actor. I think mm-hmm. It had a huge impact. Also, the things that I've read at the university, the guys from the School of Frankfurt, Adorno, Benjamin, Marcuse, these things that, you know, these guys who would think about culture and society. And I remember that when I was at the university, my fascination by the United Nations increased because I was studying geopolitics and this thing. So when I was in a university, that was a long time ago, I realized who Sergio Vieira de Mello was, and I think that that was the first time I heard his name.
Oh, really? So you were aware of him long ago?
Yeah, long ago. He was Sergio joined the UN when he was 21. He was really young. He spent 34 years of his life. He considered himself, I think, more a UN man than a Brazilian man.
Interesting.
Yeah, then he played the Brazilian guy when he needed to. He was a very pragmatic a guy. But he moved to Paris when he was really young, and he joined the Sorbonne. He studied and he graduated in philosophy, and actually he received the highest degree, educational degree, the Sorbonne could give to anyone. But he was a UN person. He was a UN man. And he had this. And though he was, of course, this intellectual, graduated by the Sorbonne as a great philosopher, and he was a man who was formed in the fields of the United Nations Agency for Refugees. So he had these two interesting qualities. He was he could think theoretically, but at the same time he was in the field. He was a guy who didn't like to be in the offices, and so he was a very unique UN person.
Going back to when you were a reporter starting out, what was the strangest or most interesting news story that you ever covered?
I wanted to be a journalist for of course, for very romantic reasons. Like I wanted to, you know, to discover something, to investigate, or to find a way to help people's lives. Or it was a very romantic point. And immediately when I, you know, started working on newspapers and things like that, all that, you know, was because the kind of things that I was sent to do were like very simple things, you know, like covering like neighbors that were fighting and what happened, and so it was a big disappointment to me. I didn't have the strength to keep going.
Yeah, well, certainly acting is more romantic. Is that part of the reason that you decided to give up journalism for acting?
I think so. Like I said, I was acting since I was 15. So I was while I was studying journalism, I was working on. In the newspapers and things like that, at night I was working on stage. Mm-hmm. So the acting and art. And I think I started to work on stage mostly because I wanted to hang out with those people. You know, those were the kind of people that I connect mm-hmm. with.
And I read, I guess I didn't know this, but I read that you're also, in addition to being an actor, you're a musician. You have a band, right? What kind of music do you play?
those are different things. I have a band, but I'm not a musician, I think.
You know, okay.
I can play instruments. I can play the guitar. I can play, the drums, and I can play instruments, but I cannot consider myself a musician. Okay. And I look at, that people that really dedicated their lives to, learning and studying and music. I can't say that, but I love playing with my band. My band is, we have this band since we were teenagers, and we keep playing. Every time I go to Brazil and to my hometown, Salvador, we play and we record things. And then, and whenever we make this little, gigs and tour in different cities, but that's really rare because most of the guys who play in my band are journalists.
Oh, really? Journalists and
musicians. One of them is an accountant.
Who does he? Is he the one who has all the best stories? The accountant.
Exactly.
Well, you have been a big star in Brazil for quite a while before American audiences first saw you on Narcos. But I think that if I have this right, you have done other films in Hollywood prior to Narcos. What was your first big breaks in terms of crossing over to American film and TV?
First film that I did here was a film called Elysium. A film directed by Neil Blomkamp with Matt Damon. That was in 2011, I think, 12. I don't remember.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was the first film that I did here.
I have to say, you were just so terrific as Pablo Escobar in Narcos. I was a big fan of that series. And wow, what a nuanced character. I mean, he's both this murderous drug lord, but then in his mind, I guess he sees himself as a hero or a Robin Hood figure.
Yeah.
How did you get into the headspace or the mentality of playing a person like Escobar?
It's interesting because so now playing someone like Sergio de Mello, who was, a man with very elevated values, and I've been answering similar questions like, so for me, Pablo Escobar was not a monster as Sergio Vieira de Mello is not a saint. Mm-hmm. Both are human beings, of course, very different persons, but I think the thing is to see them as human, as persons, as something that goes beyond the way they're usually seen. The biggest drug lord in history, or the biggest UN official in history. I think that those labels, they are not helpful for anything, but especially for an actor, that cannot, of course, judge what a character does.
Yeah, and it was sort of easy for me to almost empathize with Escobar because with your portrayal of him, you really got a sense of how trapped he felt in his world and how he could never let his guard down and could never just be happy and satisfied with what he had. He was a prisoner of his own creation. And,
yes.
And one of the things that drove that home for me, and I don't know if anyone's ever asked you about this, but I like to say that you in that role could say more with a grunt or a sigh than most actors can say with a whole page of dialogue. Do you know what I'm talking about? Where did you come up with the signature Escobar sigh?
That's a nice compliment. Thank you. I don't know. I don't know. I think he had these when you got to the place where a guy like him got, like in terms of leadership and. I think there were things that didn't need to be said. Yeah, I think so. And I think that I like the fact that you could see a lot from the way he looked at people, and that he didn't need to say anything. Yeah. I like that. I think it's a nice compliment that you made. Thank you.
Yeah, and you pulled a Robert De Niro. You actually gained 40 pounds for that role. How did you gain so much weight? And more importantly, how did you drop all that weight?
Yeah,
when it was
that's the important question. because gaining weight is the easiest thing in the world. It's just about, eating eating, you know, eating things that that a man my age wasn't supposed to be eating. Okay. But getting rid of that's complicated. So what I did was most of all, I wanted to get rid of the energy of Pablo. You know, it was, you know, mm-hmm. that wasn't my body, but that wasn't either my energy. So I did this vegan diet for a while. Till today, I don't eat meat nor chicken.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Nor is chicken. It easy to do that in Brazil? I mean, Brazilians love their meat. All the churrascarias. How do you do that?
Yeah, it's not easy, but I feel good. I feel and this thing about gaining weight is something that I want. I don't want to do it anymore. You know, I think it's not good at all. It's very bad for your health.
Okay. So only skinny rolls from now on?
Only skinny roll. Exactly. Okay. Only skinny rolls from now on.
Well, you're in great shape in this new film, Sergio.
Sergio was, you know, he was older than I am when he died in the film. The time frame that we chose for the film is the last years of his life. He was already 55. I'm 30. I'm 43. I was 42 when I shot it. And but he was pretty much in shape. He was a guy who took very good care of his physicality. He was jogging, mm-hmm. and he was a very handsome dude. And
how did you first come to this project?
For me, like I said, this all began when for my interest in the UN. Mm-hmm. I was very fascinated by this organization that is ultimately is about human rights. It's about, you know, making sure that everybody in the world is going to be respected in their most basic rights. I am a human rights activist, and this has been a very important thing in my life, and especially coming from Brazil. And I am a UN Goodwill Ambassador. I've been working with the United Nations for 10 years, I think.
You mentioned that you first became aware of Sergio de Mello when you were in college, but when did you begin to really take an interest in his story as someone you might want to play on screen?
I actually started to, I knew who Sergio was, and I knew who was an important person in the UN, but I started to pay attention and to really start to study and read and about him after he was killed, after 2003, because that was very, very shocking and strong for me, because that was the first time that the UN was a central target of terrorism.
Right, that's true.
And he was killed there.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more when we come back in just a minute. This ad is a warning. Our democracy is under attack from the U.S. Supreme Court. In the middle of a deadly global pandemic, people across Wisconsin were planning on voting absentee to keep themselves and their families safe. But the night before the election, five Republican justices on the Supreme Court told thousands of people they would have to choose between risking their lives and forfeiting their right to vote. This Supreme Court favoring Republican interests over our democracy is nothing new. They gutted the Voting Rights Act. They invited billionaires and corporations to spend unlimited amounts trying to influence elections. They gave a green light to gerrymandering, voter ID laws, and voter roll purges. Now, a progressive movement is rising up to fight back. Because it's quite possible the Wisconsin case won't be the last 2020 showdown over voting rights to be settled in the courts. And we simply can't trust this court to put aside partisan views and protect people's right to vote. Our courts are becoming too political. It's time to say enough. Learn more about how you can join the fight by visiting demandjustice.org/kick. That's demandjustice.org/kick. And I also heard that one of the things that drew you to this part was a personal desire to broaden how Latin Americans are portrayed in film and television. Tell us about that.
I want to produce more films. I'm one of the producers of this film, of Sergio. And I really want to produce films here in the U.S. about Latin people, Latinos, but films that don't reinforce stereotypes. And especially after playing Pablo Escobar, I think. Right. So I wanted to bring the example of a Latino or of a Brazilian man that, you know, that doesn't fit in stereotypes that the way Latin people have been seen in any Hollywood movies.
Do you think that sort of these superficial depictions of Latin Americans as, you know, violent Tony Montana Scarface types or Latin lovers sort of deny the depth and humanity of Latin Americans?
Yes, definitely. And especially doesn't represent what this group is in the American society. You know, we are a big social group here, and obviously the most sub-represented one. You know, not only in the in the amount of characters, but also in the, like you said, in the way that these characters are represented.
Well, it's a hell of a median deep role to play. It's a fantastic part for anyone, Latin or non-Latin. We see in this film that Sergio was sort of seen as something of a hero in places like East Timor, and he's meeting with presidents and close friends with Kofi Annan. Was he as well known in his home country of Brazil as he was everywhere else, apparently, around the world?
No, exactly. And that was another reason to make this film. I think I really wanted Sergio to be more acknowledged in Brazil, more known in there. And especially right now, where there's a big lack of good representation in my country. So, yeah, the fact that he is Brazilian, and not only in Brazil, man, I think that the coronavirus crisis is exposing how weak, how the world leaders are being exposed in their mediocrity, in their lack of values, of elevated values. And Sergio, like I said, he was a very pragmatic man. He was not a naive dude. He was a very pragmatic person, even in the way he saw human rights. But everything that he did in his life was led by very, very elevated values. And if I could summarize what this film is about, I would say that this film is about Sergio's biggest quality, which was empathy. You know, the ability of looking at people as people and not as statistics or numbers. And I think this is something that lacks a lot nowadays.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that, because I know that the film is based on a book by Samantha Power, who's been a guest of the show before. And what I always say about Samantha Power is, as cynical as we can be about politicians and diplomats, for her, one thing that is crystal clear is the job was never just theoretical or about statistics for her. She has this real empathy for how policy affects real people's lives, for better or for worse. Do you think that Sergio was pretty much the same way?
Absolutely, yes. And when you read Samantha's book, you can understand her admiration for Sergio, because she's a person who also sees the world with those lenses, with that kind of perspective.
And Sergio de Mello took on some of the toughest diplomatic posts in some of the most difficult regions of the world. What are some of the places where he worked?
Oh, everywhere. I think Sergio was probably the man of his generation who had witnessed the biggest amount of catastrophes and human suffering, and he's been Lebanon, Rwanda, Bosnia, of course East Timor, Iraq, Peru, South America, Asia. He's been everywhere, and he was because of those qualities that made him a very unique person, you know, with him, but also things that he had learned, you know, in at the Sorbonne and in his work at the UN. You know, like I said, when he started working in the UN, he started in the field. He started with refugees, like bringing shelter and food, you know, and in direct contact with poverty, with suffering, It's not a very common a thing. So Sergio was a very unique man.
Yeah, and Sergio de Mello opposed the war in Iraq on legal and moral grounds, but yet he accepted the job as UN representative in Iraq during the war. How do you think he rationalized that decision?
It isn't that tragic. I think that the fact that we chose this the last years of Sergio's life was because of all these contradictions, you know. The fact that one of the things that fascinates me about the UN is not only the role the UN has in the world, but also the dynamics of the UN and the powerful countries, especially the U.S. I mean, Trump has just said that he withdraw the money that the U.S. used to send to WHO, right? So,
yeah.
This dynamic is very fragile. The U.N. is very is still very dependent on the U.S. And so the U.N. they were clearly and openly against the invasion, and even though they had to be there to help rebuild Iraq, of course, for humanitarian reasons, but also because of its dependency of the U.S. And Sergio himself, he was personally against the invasion, and he was a very ambitious man. He knew that being in Iraq in that position could lead him to be the next Secretary General, with which everybody actually thought that he would naturally be. But even though he denied the job, I think twice or three times, and then he was convinced by George Bush and Condoleezza Rice and Kofi Annan, of course. Like you said, the fact that these men, this organization that didn't want to be there, were a target of the first terrorist attack that the UN ever suffered in history, I think it makes it even more tragic.
Yeah, he and 20 members of his staff were killed in the Canal Hotel bombing in Baghdad in 2003. Do you think that history in Iraq might have gone very differently if Sergio had lived to continue his work there?
I think so. I think so. I have no doubt about it. You know, and there's another big contradiction in all that. Sergio was, when he went to Iraq, when he was sent to Iraq, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. And when he got there, of course, he understood all the coalition were all the violations that they were doing and concerning human rights were very explicit. So all this was another big contradiction. The Canal Hotel bombing changed the way the UN operated in the world. Mm-hmm. Forever, and of course, Sergio's legacy is a legacy of diplomacy that's that you don't see anymore. You know, you don't see considering you know the geopolitics nowadays. It's something that's not, you know, when you see countries blaming other countries for the coronavirus, or you know, right. I was the other day watching an interview of a former Brazilian foreign policies minister, or the chancellor of Brazilian foreign policies. He worked under Lula, and the way he was speaking was it made me feel so nostalgic of a time where high values led, you know, this kind of conversations. You know, I think that what we are witnessing nowadays with the coronavirus is we are in a situation where the world is for sure going to change drastically after this. You know, there is it's a very unique point in our history. In my personal opinion, I think it's obvious that we are witnessing a strong crisis of capitalism itself. We don't know yet what this is going to be after but for sure it's going to be a post-capitalism that can become either a post-capitalism where societies are going to go into a more fair way, or the opposite. Because for sure, this crisis is going to raise a lot inequality, you know, in the world, and So it's the one of the anguishes of living this moment is not to know exactly in which direction the world is going to go, but for sure this is going to change. Yeah. And I think that Sergio and like I said, this minister of foreign relationships that it was, they were part of a moment in history where we were really, I think that we were going into a very interesting direction. If you believe that fairness and social justice and respect in human rights and respect and believing in climate change and believing in science and believing in culture, if all that is considered utopic, we were going into that in that direction. And I think that the world, we took the opposite path very quickly. And I think that this crisis is coming to make us think, meditate, and reflect over all this.
Yeah, I certainly think that we could stand to see a lot more of the kind of empathy that Sergio showed from our political leaders as the world copes with the coronavirus. I have to mention the director of this film is Greg Barker, another person who has been a good guest of the show. Greg is very well known as a documentary filmmaker and also spent time working as a war correspondent. Do you think his experience in war zones added an extra layer of realism to this film?
I think so. I think more than that, I think that Greg and, of course, Samantha Power, they knew so much about Sergio and about geopolitics and about, you know, that specific time frame that they chose to make the film about. I always felt very safe with Greg's knowledge of all that particular part of history.
Yeah, prior to this, Greg had made an excellent documentary about Sergio de Mello. Did you watch his documentary before you took on this role?
Many times.
Really?
Yeah, many times. And also, Greg gave us all the footage that he didn't use in the doc that he had to leave outside the doc. He gave it to us. So it was we had a lot of material about Sergio and about Iraq and the occupation.
More generally, when you play a character like Escobar or like Sergio, do you do a lot of research into the real man, or do you prefer to kind of come to the role with fresh eyes and let the script be your guide?
What I do is I make a very, very, very deep research about the character when I play, like you said, like those so-called real characters based on real people. I make a very deep research. I basically read and watch everything about this person as a researcher. And then I go to a second phase where I forget about everything that I've read or seen, and I create my own version of that character. You know, I see the character with my own eyes. I connect my feelings with that character. Because this is, I'm not Sergio, I'm not Pablo. There are things that you have to, for example, I don't know what Sergio felt when he was under the rubble, but I can put myself in that position and think, what would I think? What would I feel if I was there? Of course, so the amount of things that I've read and studied about him make me kind of behave and talk like him, and because it's so under my skin, that it's in there. It doesn't go through the path of imitation, but it comes from a deeper perspective. But at the same time, this is sort of a mix between the character and myself and how I see him and how I see the world and how I see the world he was in.
Well, you shot this film on three different continents. Did that make for a pretty grueling production schedule?
There was one of the greatest thing about this. This film, because we were making a film about a UN guy. And for me, it was very, very important to have, of course, not only different landscapes, but different locations, but different flavors and different actors and different accents and different. So we have actors from all around the world, like, you know, as a film about a UN person should be. Ana de Armas is from Cuba. Clement Schick is from Germany. Brian is from Ireland. We have actors from Angola, from Iraq, from Jordan, from Thailand. I think that that was a very important thing for the film, to have different ethnicities, different accents, different people in that film, including extras, because we used one of the beautiful things for me, the most emotional parts of the film is when all the scenes in East Timor were scenes that we shot in Thailand, but we brought Timorese's from East Timor to be in those scenes. You know, so when you see Sergio in that village, when he, you know, meets that lady, and all those people are from East Timor, and they were all of them knew Sergio, knew the importance that Sergio had to their history. And so I think that was a very important thing, regardless of what this is going to look like on the screen. For me personally, that was a very important thing.
Yeah, I was fascinated to read that all of the extras used in the Iraq scenes were actual Iraqi and Syrian refugees, and mm-hmm. the scenes that were shot in Thailand and supposed to be in East Timor used many extras who were from East Timor and mm-hmm. had actually experienced what you were filming. Did you get a chance to speak with them and hear their stories?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, we that was very beautiful. The Timorese, they were so happy to be there and to be telling that story specifically. They brought a lot of gifts for us, like coffee from East Timor and those scarves that they handmade there. And we had many conversations about the role that I was very interested in seeing and knowing their perspective for their independence from Indonesia and the role that the UN and Sergio played in all that.
Well, the film is just fantastic, a very moving movie. Once More Sergio is now streaming on Netflix. Wagner Moura, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure. Take care of yourself.
Thanks again to Wagner Moura for coming on the podcast. See him in Sergio, now streaming on Netflix. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.